Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 148, recorded January 28th, 2013.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Hello. We are here once again for your fishy pleasure. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
Why not?
I don't know. It came out and then I thought, wow, that sounded weird.
Okay, we're going to keep all of this.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Sometimes I should just practice before I talk.
Oh, come on.
But that's okay. Alrighty, so today we have Mike in Georgia and Tom in Provo and Tony in New York and Mick in the UK.
Yes. Lovely. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how should we start?
Well, let's start with Mike in Georgia. And he wants to talk about the importance of pH and acclimation.
Okay.
And you bring new fish home, and they're coming to a new pH.
Indeed.
So he says, I recently got some betas shipped through the mail, and I took special care to find out what the pH was from the seller who raised the fish. I knew that when the seller packed the beta, it was at a pH of 7.1. When they arrived, I thought I would test the pH of the water in their small bags, and it was 6.5. Now, I know that waste in the water will increase the acidity and lower the pH. Also, highly aerated water will increase the pH level. Since the beta's water had not been aerated for 2 days, the water probably had no oxygen in the water and thus lowered the pH more. I don't think the lack of light made a difference on the pH because there was not really anything in the bags to react to the photosynthesis. Now, my question, what is the best plan of action for the healthiest acclimation for the fish? Should I put it in the 7.1-ish water to match the conditions before shipping? Or should I match what is in the shipping bag and then slowly bring it to my desired pH level for the water?
Okay. Well, I think your analysis of the reason for the pH being low is pretty good. You mentioned that waste in the water will increase the acidity and lower the pH, and that that's true in general, that organic wastes have, you know, acidic nature tend to, and they will do that. And another thing to think about is the carbon dioxide that the fish have been releasing into the water and into the air. Now, that will form carbonic acid, which isn't terribly strong, but it's certainly strong enough that over time in such a small container, the carbon dioxide will actually lower the pH. And that can be a good thing in some ways, because in that small container that's closed off and limited oxygen in there, the ammonia that the fish are excreting, both through respiration and, you know, through their digestive system, is less toxic when it's in that lower pH. It becomes ammonium rather than ammonia.
It has an M on the end.
Right. So it's safer for the fish as they're in that traveling bag. But it's kind of a catch-22, because as soon as you open the bag and it becomes exposed to oxygen, the CO2 begins to, you know, diffuse out, and then you'll begin to get ammonia again.
It turns back into ammonia?
Yeah. So bad for the fish. So that's part of the reason this is such a difficult situation to deal with. And I also think you're right that the lack of light didn't have anything to do with it. So as in terms of the best plan of action, there are really, that I am aware of, three main schools of thought, or three main approaches. So we're going to talk about those three approaches.
All right, tell us the first approach.
Okay, this is sort of the quick and dirty version. It's if the fish are hardy, some aquarists get this idea that staying in that bag with the ammonia and the water and everything, and having that ammonia start to be more dangerous as it, you know, changes from ammonium, is really the worst thing to do for the fish. And so they will take, they'll put the fish, get the temperature equalized with the the new aquarium. And once they do that,
and they do that by just floating the bag?
Typically, yep, floating the bag inside the aquarium. Then they will dump the fish out into a net, and so that none of the shipping water goes in with the fish, and then put the fish into the tank. Now, this is definitely stressful, and if the pH is too far off, it can be really bad. Really bad. It can be fatal, you know, and there are some organisms that you'd never do that with, you know, sensitive invertebrates and some more sensitive fish you'd never, ever do that with, because it will kill them. And then there's other fish you can do that with without too much trouble. I mean, if you go to your local fish store, the water they're keeping in it is, you know, somewhat likely to be similar to your water, as long as they're using tap water for the water changes, and then it's not so bad. In this case, I mean, 6.5 and 7.1 is quite a difference in pH, because as our listeners, many of you already know, that the scale that pH is on is a logarithmic scale. So there is a vast difference in pH between 7 and 8.
I think he just likes to say logarithmic.
I kind of do like that word. It's kind of fun.
But sounds like rhythmic.
Sort of.
Maybe our next song should be about logarithmic
scales.
Or
pH. Or
pH logarithms.
Alkalinity and acidity. I can see that coming in.
That's verse 2, right?
Yeah, there you go. Verses about those things. Anyway, yeah, so that is a vast difference between 7 and 8. 6.5 and 7.1 is still, that's a very big difference. So you, I can understand why Mike wouldn't want to do that so quickly. And that is not my preferred method in this case. I would say you want to be a little more careful than that. So
so you wouldn't really recommend that method even with the species that are considered more hardy?
Well, with hardy species, if there's not a great pH difference,
like from
it can
your
be
local
fine.
Fish store?
Like when I go to the local fish store, I often use that method.
Okay.
And it works.
But if you're
all right.
Shipping from out of state, no.
Right. Maybe if you're shipping from out of state, because the fish are going to be stressed already. So you can think about drip acclimation. And this can work over several hours or even a day or two, depending on what you've got and the hardiness of the creature and the differences in pH. And this will help to some degree. Basically, you get the tubing. You get a piece of rigid tubing and a piece of airline tubing, for those of you who haven't used this method. And then you need to have some method of regulating the flow of the through the tubing. And this can be really simple or really complicated. One of the simplest ways is just to tie a loose knot in it. And then you can tighten it or loosen it, you know, however much you want to get slow drips. So if you get a drip going every couple of seconds, through there, then you just start a siphon in the tube.
And you're doing this into the bag that the
from,
fish comes
from
into?
From the tank into a bag, okay. Right. From the tank into a bag. And you need to have the bag, of course, in a container that's large enough so that,
right,
you know, it holds it up, supports it, and so on. And you just drip slowly in there.
Until now, what?
Until, usually, you wait until the volume of water in the bag has doubled. Then you dump out half of it, mm-hmm, and do that again. And then by the time you're done, the water's similar enough. And it's happened over a period of several hours, and the fish have had some time to adjust.
Okay.
So that's certainly less stressful in that way. Although, because you're going to put in other water that may or may not, you know, if the pH is different, the pH is higher, for example, and it's likely to have some... if the pH is higher, it's going to cause whatever ammonium is in the shipping water to turn to ammonia. So that's can be bad, of course. But one thing you can do...
Dumping out the doubled water quantity out of the bag is not going to be fast enough to take care of the ammonia.
Oh, that'll help. But the thing is, immediately, as soon as you start dripping that in, you're going to get some ammonium turning into ammonia.
That will be happening quickly.
And that will be happening, yeah, as soon as the pH starts rising in there. But that dilution will help, certainly. It will help with that problem. But to combat the problem further, you can add an ammonia remover to your dripping in water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the water in your tank water, you add some prime, for example, and that can help detoxify the ammonia by turning it into ammonium and minimize issues. And I've used that method with success with less hardy species, marine species, certain invertebrates, and so on. So that's a pretty good method.
Okay.
And probably the one I've used the most with sensitive issues. The third one is basically adjusting the pH in the new tank so that it matches that of the shipping water.
How do you do that? That seems really complicated.
Well, there's two ways to do it. One is to get add acid to the tank water, basically. You can go to the store and get like a pH decreaser.
Okay.
I don't advocate that method myself for several reasons. The biggest one being that when you do that, typically what happens is the acid will, you know, temporarily reduce the pH, but then buffers in the water will kick in and it'll bounce back up.
And then it'll be like a spike?
Yeah, nothing fish hate worse than, you know, bouncing pH, widely fluctuating pH. It's really bad for them. And so that can be scary. A better way to do it would be to use RO water mixed with tap water to get the pH you want. Because RO water has a pretty low pH, and you combine it with tap water, in the correct proportions. Of course, that's kind of frustrating to deal with because it takes a while to figure it out.
How would you redo your whole tank that way, though?
Well, that's the thing. If you're putting them in a quarantine tank or whatever, you'd have to set up the quarantine tank with that in mind. Okay. And you can do that, but frankly,
so they're not talking about... They're talking about doing that in the quarantine tank, not in the tank that you are intending to put them in?
Well, assuming you're using a quarantine tank, yeah.
But wouldn't you still have to acclimate them to the pH of the tank that you're eventually going to put them in?
Well, hopefully what you do is, once you get them acclimated to you transfer them to the tank.
The quarantine tank.
And then with small water changes over a period of days or a week or two, you replace all that water with tap water until they're in the water you want them to be in.
I see.
And so that's not so bad. But it's frustrating. It's a pain.
Labor intensive.
It's a pain to do. So I would say drip acclimation is what I would generally use, with, as I said, the ammonia remover in the water you're using, so that you're minimizing the stress caused by ammonia over that period of time.
Okay.
And do it over a number of hours, and it tends to be okay, unless you have a really really sensitive species. You might need to do it over a couple of days. Other than that, it should work just fine. And that is a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. So thanks, Mike, and hopefully that is what you were looking for.
Okay, we are going to Tom in Provo next. And he says, I have a 36-gallon aquarium with pea gravel-sized river stones as substrate and decorated with plastic plants. There are at present 6 harlequin ross boras, 6 neon tetras, 3 mature mollies, 2 small mollies, 6 small swordtails and 3 corydoras and 1 male guppy. All in all, a well-behaved and pleasant bunch of fish.
Yeah, sounds like a nice
community.
That's
a lovely description.
It is.
I had been doing water changes with RO water only because I had somehow conceived the idea that, quote-unquote, pure water would be better than tap water with minerals in it. The water in Provo is quite hard, indeed.
Indeed it is.
Okay,
we have personal
I'm going to insert a little story here.
Okay.
I'm not from Utah. I'm originally from California. I think we've brought that up a couple times. And when I first came out here to go to school, to go to college, you know, we'd been driving across Nevada and everything all day, and I was exhausted. We got into the dorms, and I go to the drinking fountain to get a drink of water, and I start drinking, and I kind of spluttered, and I spat it back out, because I really did think that there was something wrong with the drinking fountain, because it tasted so bad. Because the water is so hard. And I was not used to that. We had pretty soft water in California. And so I was just like, what is wrong with this thing? It was terrible.
Yeah, that's because you have that granite, what is it? Granite reservoir. Granite bottomed reservoir up there where you are. So you don't get a whole lot of minerals in the water. Yeah.
Yeah, every time we go to my parents' house, I go, oh, it tastes better. Yeah. Okay, anyway, so yes, water in Provo is very hard. As I have become better informed, I realize this is not necessarily so, and I've begun doing water changes with tap water treated with Tetra brand AquaSafe. Now to the questions. Number one, I had an orange snail about the size of a quarter, maybe a bit bigger. I think it was sold as a mystery snail by the pet shop. Anyway, it produced numerous tiny, less than an eighth of an inch offspring, none of which ever got beyond tiny, presumably because no calcium was to be found in the RO water. A few of them still survive months after the parent died. Is that after he's...
After what?
After he started not using RO water that some of them are
I think he's just begun recently to use the tap water.
So they're still surviving, but they're still tiny?
Right.
Okay. Is it possible that with treated tap water rather than RO water in the tank, they will grow larger?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, though, I'd just like to go back to what you said about the RO water. You're right. Straight RO water is not advised for... very many applications just because it's in terms of using it as the main water for your fish. It's great for mixing salt water with to make sure you're not adding nitrates or silicates to your salt water tank. It's great for hatching things like triops or fairy shrimp, but it's really not good for straight for hardly any fish. It basically leaches things out of their body because
there is no minerals in it.
The minerals osmote out of their body. It's bad for
them. That's no good.
But you can keep fish in really really soft, nearly RO water if you just add some minerals back, either by adding a mineral preparation that's sold for that, or just mix it with a little tap water.
I just got an image of a fish licking a salt lick.
Well, that's kind of the idea, really, with some of these salts they sell. But the idea is that if you were to mix, let's say, 20% tap water with 80% RO water, you'd get water that's really nice for some fish like angelfish or neon tetras or things like that. But you never really want to go all the way.
Okay.
Or, I've heard some people do it with discus, you know, but they probably add some minerals at any rate. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And particularly, I mean, neon tetras and harlequin asboras do better in fairly soft water. They're happy with it. But live bears, like the mollies and swordtails, not so much.
So Corys, should they not be in the same tank? Or?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would say that it sounds like they're doing well, and I'm sure they are. Mm-hmm. Fish do adapt to various hardnesses and pHs, you know, and mm-hmm. they do fine. But neons prefer more acid, softer water, and so do harlequin asboras and typically corys too, depending on the corys. But the live bears all do better in harder water. So the tap water will certainly be better for them.
Okay,
so going to the orange snail and the baby snails, I would guess that the snails would do better in the harder water, and they may begin to grow. I've never encountered this particular difficulty. I have had mystery snails and had them produce young, and had some of them grow up.
Is that the one that laid the egg case on the
yeah,
light
the bottom
fixture?
Of the light fixture. Yeah, they lay their eggs out
they
of the water.
It crawled up there, and
it laid a couple of egg cases. And
I don't know if I'm remembering this wrong, but it mm-hmm. looked almost like kind of a wet mantis egg case.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
It was kind of like a chalky color, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was. And it's fairly dry and brittle to the touch, and it is moist inside, though, of course, and once it starts to hatch, the sort of dissolves and drips down into the tank. But yeah, I think it's a very good possibility that the calcium in the water will help the snails to grow. I hope so. And let us know how it goes and what happens.
And I think before we go on to his next question, we should take our break.
Okay.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nine.
Okay, his second question is about using a python.
He says, this is Tom in Provo, right?
Oh, yeah, we're still on Tom. The new water regimen opens the possibility of using a python water changer. I am wondering, though, if there's a problem with outgassing. Might the fish be subject to bubble disease with such a system? Any other potential problems?
Okay, well, let Kelly start out. She wanted to say this.
Oh, I love the python. I'm going to say that. I have memories of before we got Russ the python and lugging water and spilling water and
buckets.
That's my pet peeve. If everybody, I hate having wet on the floor. I hate stepping in wet in my socks or in my bare feet or otherwise. I hate sitting down on the floor and there's a wet spot. I hate wet on the floor.
Yep. So she loves the python.
I love the python.
And I would say too that it's the best aquarium investment I've ever made. At least one of the top three.
I think it's your most used.
Yeah.
Accessory.
I use it every time I do water change.
Mm-hmm.
And any tank over 5 gallons, I use it. Mm-hmm. And the tank that I probably do the most water changes in, just to address the gas bubble disease question, I change about 50% of the water on our 37-gallon goldfish tank twice a week. That's my current regimen, which I recently stepped up because we put more goldfish in it. But anyway, I haven't encountered problems with outgassing in that tank. I would say that I do try to keep bubbling to a minimum when I put it in by making sure the python gravel washer is full of the gravel washer itself is under the water and it's full of water before I start filling. Now, recognizing that most of the bubbles from that cause gas bubble disease and the outgassing are under pressure and kind of in solution, they come out of solution when they go into the tank. I don't know why doing what I just explained would help, really, but it seems to. And the only time I've had outgassing occur with the python is when I fill a nearly empty tank. Like when there's 20% of, or less of water in the tank and I add, you know, all that water.
But you're going to get outgassing problems when you fill up a tank from scratch or nearly scratch anyways.
Yeah, as long as it's coming out of the pipes. Mm-hmm. If it's sitting in a, like a reservoir
if
first.
If you've had it curing, then...
Right, then it won't. But
because it already outgassed.
Right, but otherwise you'll have that issue. But
it does have to outgass at some point.
That's part of the reason you don't want to do like 80% water changes mm-hmm. unless you have the facility to do so, like Mick does or some of our other listeners. They do have reservoirs where they have water that's mm-hmm. you know, ready and so on, so then it's fine. But you wouldn't want to do it otherwise. But anyway, I've done 50% water changes with Python, and it works. So I would say not really an issue.
Does it partly depend on your water pressure?
Oh, sure, it does. I would imagine so. So I would say if you have really high pressure water, it might be something different, but you can turn it down and that might help some, and just bear that in mind. There are some other issues you can have with pythons too. One is that you need to be careful that there's the hookup at the sink with the Venturi on it, and then there's a valve that's near the gravel washer, so you can operate it by hand when you're using the gravel washer. And that portion of the python on that valve, if you close it while the tank is on the fill setting, or they have the hookup and the sink on the fill setting, a lot of pressure builds up really fast, and you can actually, something's going to give, and something does, inevitably. What has happened, it's been a long time since this has happened, because I've had pythons for years, and quickly learned not to do this, but if you leave it on for any length of time, more than just a few seconds, when it's on fill, it will pop the hookup to the sink right off, and then you'll get water shooting everywhere. So I would advise against doing that. Anything else about that you can think of? Just make sure you have a sink that drains properly so you don't flood mm-hmm. your bathroom or your kitchen. Anything else?
You do have to bleach it out occasionally because it stays wet inside, and so it gets wet, growy things. But that's not that big of a deal. Okay, so Tony's third question.
Oh, this is Tom.
Sorry, wrong T name. They both start T-O. Yeah. Sorry,
and
guys.
And Tony's coming later in the show, so.
Tom's third question is, while I enjoy the tank as it is, I would like a planted tank, and I'm thinking of changing to mostly rockscape with a few undemanding plants, such as Anubias, Java fern, and maybe some hornwort. Is there any advantage to adding the plants one at a time over a couple of months as opposed to planting the whole thing at once?
Well, a couple of advantages, yeah. And not necessarily that you should do it this way, but if you want to look at it in terms of advantages, one is if you put some Anubias in there and they don't do well, then you know that it's not ready for Java fern, probably, or hornwort, and you need to make some adjustments. And then once you get the Anubias thriving, then it's a fairly good bet that Java fern might do well. And you can try that, and if that's doing well, you can add the hornwort kind of thing. Now that's possible. Okay. That's one way to look at it anyway. The thing is, Anubias is probably, out of the three, the least demanding in my experience. In terms of light, it really doesn't need much. And I've had tanks where Anubias throve, whereas Java fern didn't do as well. So I would say that is one thing to think about. And then Java fern can do with even less light than hornwort, typically. So there you go. That's the order I would suggest trying it, and if you want to do that. I don't know what your lighting is like in the 36-gallon or what shape the 36-gallon is, but typically if it's the light that came with the tank, it's probably not enough to do a whole lot with. I mean, maybe Anubias will do well, but I wouldn't necessarily think that Java fern will do well unless you're getting enough ambient light in the room as well. A 20-gallon tank with one fluorescent tube over it, I've grown Anubias in there pretty well, but the Java fern didn't do as well. Then with some ambient light on a tank like that, on the other hand, the Java fern can do okay. So there's just a few things to think about. Now, one thing about hornwort, when it floats, it can grow in really low light as long as there's a light right above it, because it's so close to the light, it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. So that's something to think about too. And incidentally, the hornwort does well in hard water and not so well in soft water typically, so there's something that will help with the hornwort. And speaking of hornwort, we'll address that later because it relates to a question that Tony had.
Okay, so let's go to Tony.
Okay.
He says, thanks for talking about zebra danios and red cherry shrimp on the show last week. Russ, as you correctly guessed, I was considering overflow shrimp for the zebra danio tank, especially since I expect to have hundreds of them sometime soon. That, plus if I'm to keep shrimp, then why not enjoy them in all of my tanks? And he says to Mick, yes, Mick, I am indeed doing the happy shrimp dance, the tune of the surface area song. Shrimp are fantastic. I join you, Juliet, and of course Aquarimax in the glorious invert hobby at last.
Yay!
And here's his shrimpy update for the week. Firstly, the shrimp arrived and are doing great in their dedicated 6.6-gallon aquarium. This aquarium is just for them and their zebra nerite friends. Even though temperatures in New York were at or below 0 degrees Fahrenheit during their 3-day journey from Texas, every shrimp was swimming furiously when I unpacked them. That's a relief.
It is.
It's very, nice to see
everyone
cold.
Survived.
Shipped along with them was a strand of hornwort. How interesting, this plant is new to me. I read up on it just a touch, and wow, it seems like a great and hardy plant. I've read in several places that it can grow an inch or two per day. Is that possible? On the other hand, it disposes of various aquatic waste with a vengeance. As I read on, I can't believe what an incredible miracle plant this seems to be, which has come to me fully by coincidence. And he says, Russ and Kelly, I implore you, please chat about the miracle of hornwort on an upcoming podcast. Can we make a t-shirt that says the miracle of hornwort? That is an awesome phrase. Does that just not roll trippingly off the tongue?
And we can have a picture of a couple of red cherry shrimp dancing around on a piece of it.
Yeah! Mm, they'll have, like, shrimp disco.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. How far do you think it can go towards keeping the water clean? Could it even stave off water changes? That might be a question for my API test kit, but I suspect the answer goes beyond ammonia, nitrites, and nitrates. Hope it is warmer than zero where you are, and talk to you soon. It's been sort of warmer than zero. It's actually been better this week. We've even gotten into the 30s. Okay, so his first question, can it really grow an inch or two per day?
Yeah, it can. I've seen it. I don't know about 2 inches for sure, but I've seen it grow 1 inch in my tank, 1 inch per day, plenty of times in my tank. If it's doing well, it'll do that. It'll grow that fast.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's like a 13-year-old boy.
Something like that.
Yeah. I think ours grows 1 or 2 inches per day.
Seems like it. So what else did he say about it? He wanted to know...
Well, he wanted to know about... could it stave off water changes?
Well, I would say that since it can certainly reduce the nitrates in your tank, and that's good, but it can't really replace trace elements that you're replacing in tap water. And there may be other things like dissolved organics that it's not taking out of the water to the extent that it would need to. That said, we can go the aquaponics route. There are people who can maintain certain aquatic environments by just maintaining lots of healthy plant matter and not really doing water changes, just topping off. But I would say under ideal conditions, to create an ideal situation for your aquatic animal life, I would say no. But it will certainly go a long way towards maintaining the water quality.
And you had said before it does actually leach calcium out of the water.
Yeah, hornwort uses a fair amount of calcium in the water, and so you can... conceivably lead to problems like a pH crash if you have a lot of hornwort and they're not doing water change. Eventually, you'll run out of buffers.
So not adding that back in.
Right, and that could be an issue eventually.
Okay, we heard back from Tony with a follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, lots of times you see the statement that plants are great at removing nitrates from the water. In this context, do they mean the least poisonous form, nitrate, or are they referring instead to ammonia, nitrite, and nitrate? I've always suspected the latter, but always wondered about this.
Okay, well, this is what I have heard and read. Hopefully I'm stating the right thing, because I'm not referring to anything. This is based on pure memory here, but that plants can and do use nitrates, but many plants prefer ammonium, and if they can get it, they will use that in preference to nitrate. I guess it's metabolically easier to use. In other words, it's easier to break down, or it's already in a form that they can use more quickly. So ammonium is the preferred, with an M at the end, but that they'll use nitrate if they can't get that. And I think that probably varies depending on plant species, but that's the general rule that I understand. So great question, though. Never gotten that one. I like that. So thanks, Tony.
Okay, we're going to go to Mick now.
And he says, just taken in the last show while doing the water tests and changes at work this morning. It's nice and quiet first thing so I can give the podcast my full attention.
Oh, it's nice to know that somebody does. No, I know that lots of our listeners like to listen to our podcast, so thank you all to all of our listeners.
They're our listeners, exactly. I hope. So Mick says, I was so excited to hear about the Amano shrimp hiding out in your tank. Just goes to show what hardy blighters they are. I'm sure I didn't say that nearly as cool.
Well, it would sound cooler in his accent, it's
hardy
true.
Hardy blighters. That's not Mick's accent, though, huh? That's okay. I digress. I have several in the Paludarium, and mine are quite ancient by the sounds of things. 5 years old.
Wow.
Still growing strong okay. And very lively.
Mick, I think you win the Geriatric Shrimp Award. Not That's for yourself. You're not a geriatric shrimp, but your shrimp are.
Well, he's neither shrimp nor geriatric, so...
Oh, I know.
On the subject of books, these days books are likely to be out of date by the time they hit the printing press. Indeed, that's kind of...
Yes.
What we were trying to say, too.
Yep, he's agreeing with us, yep.
Having said that, sometimes it's good to have a bit of bulky paper to weigh through, so I suggest the... Bench?
I think people
B-A-E-N-S-C-H.
Pronounce that however they want to.
S-C-H.
Yeah.
Bench.
I don't know how people say
Bansk.
It.
I don't know. But it's B-A-E-N-S-C-H.
Yeah.
Atlas. Volume 1 is a good all-rounder and gives a wide index of fish and plants with lots of general info besides, so that's good. We have another
True, and I should have mentioned that there. One, so I'm glad you brought that one up. I did think of it, but I didn't mention it, so thank you, Mick.
He says, I picked up a pair of gold rams at work last week. Lovely little fish and seem to be settling into their tank here. I'm building them up with white worm and tubifex worm as well as the usual pellet food, so fingers crossed for spawning soon. I have attached a picture.
Oh, yeah. He has the best water for rams.
Yeah.
He's got rainwater.
Do we have the picture?
He has his cistern. We'll put it up.
Okay.
Yeah, rams are beautiful fish.
He says, hope to see the snapping shrimp on Facebook soon. Oh, and I didn't have that up yet. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. We'll put it up soon.
Yeah, I'll get it up this week. This P.S. For those of us with a heavier build, most T-shirts automatically have a large surface area.
We really do need to get those T-shirts, don't we?
Oh, that's good. Yes, we need to get T-shirts done. So thank you to Mike and Tom and Tony and Mick.
And until next week,
may the fish
be with you. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.